I'm inside, but I'm wearing a stocking cap. Hello, everybody, to the Pick Six Podcast. Sammy came along with Evan Bland here on a frosty Thursday. It's going to get even colder. It's been a busy week of Husker sports already. Evan, how are you today?
Hanging in, Sam. We're hunkering down here, what, on a midday Thursday, ready for Snowmageddon coming in. It's all good, man. It reminds me of a pro tip I once received. If your car is stuck in the snow, you put some towels under the back of your tires, and it allows you to back out. So anyone listening who may get stuck in the snow in the coming days in the area, that's a little tip. When I was living in an apartment, that saved my bacon more than once. So I always think about stuff like that when the snow's set to arrive, like a looming specter.
That's good to know.
Yeah, a little fun fact.
I tell you, you're full of them. Very handy of you to think about that. It feels like it's already been Snowmageddon this week. We missed 2 days of school. Probably going to miss another one on Friday. So yeah, it's been an interesting week in the household of people who have kids that are going to school. It's also been a really interesting week in the room of Nebraska athletics. We're going to start where our primary beat is, if that's okay, and that's football. We're a football podcast first and foremost, and so I know Nebraska beat Purdue, and we'll get to that in a second, but I want to be able to start with Husker football. And it's been an interesting week there. A team that we didn't think was going to get a lot of transfers, my goodness gracious me, has added 4 transfers in the last 6 days. That's something. And all of them have been on the offensive side of the ball, too.
Yep. That's right. The Micah Mazzucca one, to me, is sort of a unique moment in the brief history of Nebraska in the portal, because usually you see these things coming. Like, they come on official visits, and that indicates interest, and they go from there. Mazzucca was a guy a year ago who visited Nebraska, had him among his finalists, chose Florida. And so, to my knowledge, he was not on anybody's radar coming into this week as a guy that they could potentially add. And if it weren't for the NCAA ruling that multi-time transfers, undergrads, can move and have immediate eligibility, he would have gone to the NFL. And instead, middle of the week, he puts out there, he's coming to Nebraska. And like, boom, just like that, they've got a multi-year Power 5 starter at guard coming in to a team that just so happens to need one and possibly two starters at guard, depending on what Ethan Piper decides to do coming off his knee injury. So like, that to me was it was just remarkable. Like, as much of a heater as Nebraska was on anyway, with guys like Isaiah Nayor and Dante Dowdell, like, to get Mazzucca in, to me, was like the ultimate heat check for what Nebraska was doing. And then today, here on Thursday, they add their next piece in Jamal Banks, the receiver from Wake Forest. Like, it just, again, furthers this idea that Nebraska is so good at identifying what they need, bringing in those guys, leveraging relationships. And like you said, everybody this month is on the offensive side. Everybody's going to be in contention to be a starter next year for Nebraska. All those guys could be starters for Nebraska next season. So really remarkable week in the portal for sure.
And Stephon Thompson of Syracuse might, commit as a linebacker soon, too. That would be the last one. I know you've been doing all the transfer stuff. I really liked your conversation with Jamal Banks. We're recording this on a Thursday. You talked to him, I think, this morning. Just a guy that kind of knows what he wants and had other opportunities. I think this is the key. With Banks, he could have gone to Wisconsin or Purdue or Minnesota. He did make a visit to Michigan. I don't really know what the story is there, because I don't know that Michigan knows what they're doing. After they won the national championship. And we'll talk about that too. But Banks just seems like a kid that really understands what he's coming here to do.
Really mature kid. I mean, he offered some of his life story growing up, and he had, different things in life growing up in Washington, D.C. that I think shape a guy and has really made him intentional about how he views life, I think. Really investing in other people and being intentional with what he does. And he saw a lot of those things at Nebraska. He saw that, like, What I thought was interesting when you kind of break down why he went to Nebraska, he lists all the stuff that most places do, the facilities and the coaches and the schemes and all that. But like I think he recognized in some of his future teammates a similar drive that he has. He mentioned Malachi Coleman and Jalen Lloyd and Dylan Raiola, Cam Linhart. Like I think in talking with him, he identified that same hunger, that same drive that he has. And so to me, this was not a case of like, guy looking for bigger platform, guy looking for better facilities, whatever, because he had a lot of that stuff at Wake. It was about being around more like-minded people. And again, when you look at what he did, as a playmaker at Wake for 2 years, like he comes in and fits what Nebraska wants too. So like he struck me not just as a schematic fit, but also very much a cultural fit as a really mature guy. Kind of reminded me of Samori Toure a little bit from a couple of years ago and how he handled himself. I think it'll be a really good locker room fit as well as on field.
Agreed. You had talked about also Dante Dowdell. You had covered him, and I think talked to his dad. Maybe you talked to Dante too. You did talk to Dante. His factoring in what he was doing, again, Dylan Raiola, part of that recruiting process. This feels like the addition that most intrigues me, because I feel like you have a question mark at that power back with Gabe Urban. And you have a question mark with whether Ramir Johnson's going to come back 100% from a shoulder injury. It feels like Dowdell has picked the school where he could best have an opportunity to play right away.
Yeah, it does. And like you think about some of the guys that Nebraska's missed of late, whether that was Kawan Lacy backing out of the class or AJ Allen transferring after he looked like a promising young back for Nebraska. Like in essence, Dowdell makes up for that. He's got 3 years left. And he was again somebody who like circumstances were really unique that brought him to Nebraska. He said if they had redshirted him in four games, he probably would still be there. And it just so happened he appeared in six. If one of their other starters ahead of him hadn't gotten hurt and medically redshirted, he would have stayed because he would have likely been the number two guy there and split carries. And so neither of those things happened. He's a running back. He felt the urgency, I suppose, the clock ticking when it comes to that position in particular. And I mean, Nebraska lands a top 10 back at that position from the 23 cycle. And you've mentioned it in your takes, like he's got a really unique blend of power and speed, comes from grew up in sort of a military background. So he's been about hard work his whole life, just has the mentality that you're looking for. And again, somebody else who really connected with Dylan Raiola on campus over the weekend fits a position of need, certainly for what Nebraska has. And it sets up a really interesting spring competition, don't you think, with Irvin and Ramir, Emmett Johnson, who got a lot of run last year, Quentin Ives. It's going to be a really interesting battle.
Yeah, I'll be curious to know if Gabe Urban and Ramir Johnson are healthy enough to participate in spring camp. I'm not sure you need Ramir Johnson to participate in spring camp because I think you know what Ramir can do. And it's a shoulder injury, so it doesn't affect his bottom half, his legs. Urban had a hip injury, so you absolutely need to see what he can or can't do, and maybe he can't do much during spring. He's a great kid, great culture kid, but you have to figure out what he can do physically. Emmett Johnson's a player that, I'll be honest with you, outperformed my expectations. Now, what the hell do I know? But I thought he played pretty darn well last year. Kept things between the tackles, held up physically, played well in fourth quarters, broke tackles, had the huge run at Wisconsin to help them get down there and have an opportunity to tie that game and go into overtime. Had the huge touchdown run against Purdue, did a lot of his best work in the fourth quarter. And then we don't know anything about Ives other than what I've heard rumblings is they like him, but they didn't want to show him because they didn't put him out there and they had opportunities to do so and they just didn't do it. So maybe they're hiding him because they feel like he's got some really nice pieces. At the same time, they didn't have a moment in the last five games of the season. Was it the last five games, four games? They didn't have a moment in the last four games of the season where they were even like ahead.
They're all nail biters. Yeah.
Everything was real tight there in the last four games of the year. So it wasn't like they were in moments where they could do other things. I will be intrigued to see how Dowdell fits in. He plays between the numbers, which probably isn't a term that any coaches use, but What I mean by that is he is not necessarily looking to get to that lane between the numbers and the sideline where there's oxygen out there. But a lot of times it takes a lot of energy to get out there. And a lot of times guys can try to take that circuitous route and they actually don't gain any yards. Whereas Dowdell is a one cut and go guy. What that means is his shoulder pads may be perpendicular or at a 70 degree angle to the line of scrimmage, but once he makes that cut, the shoulder pads are square to the to the field, and you've got to deal with tackling. And I think they need that back. Gabe Irvin is a really good shake for a big guy. He can move a little bit at that second level, but there are times when I wish he would just square his shoulders too. So I think Dowdell's a really interesting addition. Let's be clear. And we didn't point it out a ton during the season, but this is a team that, had 31 turnovers and then scored 18 points a game during the season. This was the worst offense Nebraska's had in 50 years. And so you can make any justification going forward for what you want to do based on that. And they've added some players. And how do you say his name? Mazkua?
Mazooka,
Mazuka?
like bazooka with a
Yep. So
damn,
Mazuka is a player that I'm gonna guess that he's a starter. We don't know what Ethan Piper is gonna do, but I think he will be a starter, and I think Justin Evans-Jenkins will be the other starter, and then you got Henry Lutovsky in a rotation. He's a guard, so I'm sure they'll find a spot for him. And then if he has to swing out to tackle, maybe he can do that too. The question mark at Nebraska is tackle. Ben Hart and Prochazka have to stay healthy. And then after them, Tyler Kanak, I guess. Maybe Roquan Buckley if he
Corcoran,
does.
if he's still there.
Well, Corcoran, yeah. Corcoran, I think, is deep down, I think he's an interior guy. And it could be Corcoran. It very well could. I think at some point, that guy deserves an opportunity to play the position that he might play in the NFL. Because I do think Corcoran's an NFL player. So it'll be interesting to watch. I think offensively, they still have a lot of work to do. I was struck by Banks' comment on Dylan Raiola today related to the spin, the tight spin that he gets on the ball, and the depth that he gets during the course of his workout. That's really notable. That he's able to do that as a true freshman, and that he's able to, get it going, so to speak, quote unquote. So, that's something notable. And then, on the defensive side of the ball, they added Bly Hill last semester in December on signing day, and Stephon Thompson to add too. And there's a lot of pieces already on that side of the ball that I think are pretty well set, and they just had to get guys back, and guys are coming back. So you kind of see where Nebraska wants to go. Matt Rhule made an interesting comment this week. So he was at the AFCA coaches convention in Nashville, and I think he was still there, or he had just gotten back, and he did like a 20-minute interview with Brian Baldinger, who's really good, and another guy. And early in the conversation, he says the phrase, "We think we can be pretty good pretty quickly." And I don't think he said that because he was trying to make a sales pitch. I mean, this isn't about recruiting anymore. They've got as many guys as they need. Like they just signed 28 in the first class, or 29 or 30, and 28 in this one. This isn't like a universe where it's like still about we need to make sure that there's 28 more guys we can draw to this team. So he's talking about the players who are already here. I don't think he's making a sales pitch, and it sounded like he believed it. It was more of a relaxed interview. I don't think he was trying, I don't think he was in pitch mode. Let's set aside whether we agree with that or not. What do you think he's thinking about as it relates to why he'd think they'd be really good? What markers do you see that would make it sense that he would think that?
Well, I think it's the things that he talks about a lot. I think it starts with the line of scrimmage. You got to like what they have on the defensive line coming back. And everyone knows the names with Putmaker and Ty Robinson and Lenhart and Prince Will and on and on. I think, I listened back to what he said about the offensive line after the season and saying like they like the talent. And now it's about an offseason and strength training and getting stronger. I think You got to feel good about that. And then you add Mazuka to the mix there as a total out of nowhere gift that they, I'm guessing, were not planning on. And then again, you look back at the season that they just had, and you mentioned the turnovers, the giveaways on offense, the struggles on that side of the ball, historically bad for what Nebraska's been the last half century. And yet they were 5-7. And so if you play back last season with a quarterback that takes care of the ball with some skill players at a couple of different spots, like say receiver and maybe a versatile running back. I mean, who's to say Nebraska couldn't have won 9 games last year? So like, I think they were ahead of what they thought they were going to be in year one with some of the players that were there. They saw development from a number of them, particularly on the defensive side. And then you go out and you pretty much hit on everything that you could hope for. I mean, Raiola was not on their radar until he had a change of heart in December. So you address that position. You hit on some of the other deficiencies. You get back your defensive coordinator and Tony White, and you're going into year two where you've got the cultural foundation set, where guys know what to expect. They know kind of what things are all about, and now it's time to roll. Like I kind of think that's what it is. Like they put in a lot of the elbow grease in year one, and now it's time to see some of that paying off. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, so a couple of things that I think are, first of all, I like your answers, and I think line of scrimmage is legitimate, right? Like in 2024, Nebraska should have a line of scrimmage on the offensive and defensive sides of the ball that can win most of those battles. And I include in that teams that you don't necessarily think they should just, smack around. I think they're going to be better than Wisconsin on the line of scrimmage. I don't know that I've said that ever
Yeah.
since Nebraska joined the Big Ten, but I think they're going to be better than Wisconsin on the line of scrimmage next year, because Wisconsin's replacing some stuff, and so I think there's some of that. I think that's absolutely true. I think sometimes you can say things and mean them, but also mean them because you need to mean them. And what I mean by that is, Nebraska needs to get good quickly. I don't think there's a lot of like time to ponder and to mull it over. Like I think it's time to be what you want to be. And I think the team can get good pretty quickly, but they need to get good pretty quickly because the train's gonna be moving real quick after this season. 2024, there is an opportunity. And I think everybody knows it. I don't think they're gonna speak it too much. Maybe we as the media will, but I don't know that they'll overdo it rhetorically. But this is the team that gets to spend the first month of the season at home. This is a team that in the first 7 games gets to take 2 trips to the state of Indiana, which is not known for football. And should give Husker fans an opportunity to go to some football games. This is a program that has an opportunity to do some things in the front end of that season. And it needs to not merely be a sense of positivity around it, of like, hey, we're going to be good, but also a sense of urgency. And so I think that's part of it. What you see from the defense should give people a lot of encouragement simultaneously. What needs to happen on the offense is a fundamental unknown. And so I think part of what Matt Rhule is doing there is he's also speaking into existence the confidence that he thinks his players need and want in order to get where they need to go. There's a bunch of early top 25s coming out right now. I'll probably have one in the next couple of weeks. I'm going to wait until the transfer portal settles out. Tons of people did, for example, a way too early top 25 on Tuesday before Nick Saban retired. Didn't make a hell of a lot of sense. Nor does it make a lot of sense to do a way too early top 25 when we don't know what Jim Harbaugh is going to do. Like these things matter. Nick Saban just retired. When Tom Osborne retired, Nebraska lost 4 games the next year. And if Alabama loses 4 games next year, they're sure as hell not going to be number two in the country. So like you can't just do this right away. You have to wait for the dominoes to tip and then you do one. And so it'll be a week or so. But I'm curious. You watch quite a bit of college football. You watch the bowl games. I know you're a bowl game guy. Do you feel like the components that Nebraska has returning relative to the components other teams have would it surprise you if somebody, not necessarily me, but somebody in the national media said, you know what? Nebraska is going to be in the top 25 next year.
Well, we've seen this before. We saw this at the start of the 2019 season when Nebraska didn't make a bowl game and they were put in the top 25. And I know I've heard Adrian Martinez and others from that program at the time say that that probably wasn't the best thing for them. They hadn't earned it. They had to sort of deal with it before they actually made it happen on the field.
Yeah, that's on their
But
coach. That's on their former coach.
sure.
He
But
needed to
so
do a better
anyway,
job. I don't
I
want to,
don't.
I'm going to interrupt you because you're exactly right. Simultaneously, if you're not screwing around with some situation with Maurice Washington for 2 months in the spring, which they were, which was an issue of their own making, then maybe you prepare your team a little bit better than he did. Because if you want to point at a year where, and I haven't been as hard on Frost as other people have, but if you want to point at a failure, that year was a failure because he did not prepare his team well enough. They didn't go into the season adequately prepared to handle the expectations, including the quarterback. And part of it was because they spent whole chunks of the offseason dealing with a scandal that they didn't have to do. So he's right. That's on their coach. Their coach needed to do a better job. He didn't handle Big Ten media days that year very well. Somebody at Bill Moose, set him up with that 6-6 thing, and he didn't handle that well.
Yeah.
I don't think Scott did everything wrong in 2021 and 2022, the onside kick notwithstanding. And there was he got a lot of criticism at times when I thought it was kind of whatever, but 2019's all on him. He did not have a good year that year. I think that's what cost him, honestly.
He
Because if they
didn't.
went 8-4 that year, I don't know what I just don't think things proceed the way they would have after.
Yeah, that's an interesting what if. And that very well may be. The fact still remains, though, that Nebraska had no business really being ranked outside of the excitement that they generated late in the 18 season, almost beating Iowa. And Adrian Martinez was a dark horse Heisman candidate and all the rest. But,
That's all fair.
but the goalposts have moved too. I think that's the other interesting part when you talk about what could a breakout season look like? For the last decade, there's no chance that Nebraska was going to play in the college football playoff. I mean, that might as well have been a different sport that was occurring. There was, outside of the brief moment in 2016 when they started undefeated, like that just wasn't on anybody's radar at any point. But as we've talked about that on the show before, like to finish top 15, top 12, to be an Arizona type, to be an Iowa type, and be in contention, like for something that really matters in November and December, yeah, I think Nebraska could do that. And they're not, I think that there is a chance that they could be ranked early in the season because of the schedule and how it sets up, like you said, but also because it feels like there's a strong foundation here. This is not, as much as we've been talking about the portal this week, that's not what the foundation of this thing is being built on. It is being built on the lines, both sides. Now you have a quarterback to build around. And I know the history isn't great about freshman quarterbacks leading the way, but like there's some hope there. There's potential there. There's a lot of intrigue about what that could look like moving forward. So yeah, to answer your question, I think there are a lot of pieces that are comparable to teams that you would find in the top 25 along the lines. Suddenly, maybe at the skill spots, I still think. The back end of the defense, linebackers and defensive backs, maybe have a little bit of proving to do just through some of the guys that are coming up and what they lost. But I think the pieces are there. And like you mentioned, again, the schedule sets up well that yeah, I think you start off 2-0, 3-0, you might see a number next to your name.
Let me rattle off these Power Five names to you, and I'll ask you the question at the end. Michigan, Penn State, Ohio State, Notre Dame, Iowa, Clemson, Georgia, UCLA, Utah, Rutgers. Do you have any idea what those teams have in relationship with each other?
Better tell me.
Okay. First, I'll ask you the question. How many of those teams, tell me which of those teams that I just rattled off won't be in the preseason top 25?
Rutgers,
And maybe UCLA.
UCLA, yeah.
Everybody else is though, right?
Yeah, I would think so. Yep.
Yeah. Those are the other, I think, 10 Power Five defenses that are ranked around Nebraska for total defense from last year. After Rutgers comes Alabama, then Texas A&M, then Virginia Tech, then Louisville, Oregon, Miami of Florida, and Florida State. So Nebraska has a top, they have a defense that would tell you they're going to be in the top preseason top 25. The problem is they didn't have the offense that was commensurate with it. And most of the teams I just rattled off there have much better offenses, with the exception of Iowa. So and Rutgers didn't have a very good offense either, but it was better than Nebraska's. The point being that, like, the defensive metric tells you that they're among one of the better teams in the country. The problem is their offense was historically bad. And if they can just get 5 to 7 more points out of that group, there's really no reason why Nebraska can't be where Matt Rhule wants them to be next year, which is going into late October, having to field questions about where they are relative to the top 12. And
I agree.
the playoff changes everything. It changes every conversation that we have about college football. 12-team playoff changes everything, because there's a team that's, 4-2 in October that's like, F this, we can still make the thing. We ain't out of anything. Right? Like, there's going to be a team that's like, yeah, we can go on it. Let's go on it. Let's be the Buffalo Bills. Why not? We can do it. There's going to be a team that's 6-1 that's going to be like, yeah, we win 4 more games and we're screwing around with this playoff thing in early December. So it's going to expand the number of teams that have hope. And as a byproduct, it's going to expand the number of teams that are playing their tails off in November. Because it won't be, well, we're 6-3 and we kind of already know we're going to a bowl, but we're playing Ohio State this week and we might fall down 14-0 and then we're going to the Hurt Locker. No, we're down 14-0 and our playoff lives are on the line. We're going to play through it. Because if we beat Ohio State, then we might get closer to the playoff, that kind of thing. It's going to make life harder for the best team. Because now all of a sudden, that 6-2 team's playing for something. They're not just playing for pride or for a feather in the cap. They're playing for positioning.
And when you frame it that way too, I think it adds perspective on what we've seen Nebraska do. I mean, the way that they were going to attack quarterback before Raiola made his flip, the way that they've added players in the portal this month, seemingly, despite the fact that their roster numbers are way over and that they're going to have to figure that out later, the way that they're reassessing what their offensive staff's going to look like, who's going to coach quarterbacks, how that looks, exploring options with a guy like Dana Holgorsen. Like, I think that all those moves illustrate kind of what you're saying, where it's like, okay, if you have the defensive side more or less figured out, you have a lot of your contributors back there, you feel good about that side of the ball, then you got to go all in and get those pieces now and figure it out. And if you can just be an average offense, be slightly above average, find a little bit more consistency in special teams. Like, there's no reason that they can't get back to a bowl and then quite a bit more. I believe that I understand kind of the skepticism because there's always optimism in the off season. People have been talking about it for 15 years. Is Nebraska back? But I don't know. It feels different, does it not? Even independent of the 12-team playoff, just what Nebraska's building seems different. To me, at least. But you covered the bulk of the Pelini era and all the rest. Does it feel that way to you, or do you think the playoff is sort of affecting maybe what the optimism could be for Nebraska because the bar is a little lower?
It feels different because I think the head coach in charge isn't coming into an off season vaguely morose like Pelini. No offense to Bo, he won a lot of games. But like every offseason felt tense because it's like, all right, what conflict are we going to manufacture to get us going? Doesn't feel like Riley, that era never felt like it got on full footing. You never quite trusted it. And then with Frost, it just always felt this, you going into spring, it just felt disorganized. And there was always something. First year was Rabdo, second year was Maurice Washington. Obviously COVID in 2020 really hurt that momentum. In 2021, the whole stuff with Oklahoma and, dissension and the operation and Bill Moose against Frost. And then in 2022, it actually felt pretty quiet, but, and then you had the, I don't know, it just always felt like there was something with Nebraska football, always something under Frost. And it doesn't feel like that way with Rule. Feels like it's been, you just kind of know he's going to go to work every day and try to get the thing better and has an organized operation. All right, let's do 10 good minutes on basketball. Nebraska basketball beats Purdue on Tuesday night. It was a magical night. It wasn't a huge crowd. There was 14,106 listed, but probably wasn't that many people. It's probably around 11 or 12. In 15 years from now, it'll be 25,000 who say they were there. And they just, you don't know it when you're at the beginning of the game. You know it at the end of the game. But at the very beginning of the game, Rick Mass hits a three, and it's like, okay, it's on. Like Nebraska was just, they were just dialed in. From the very beginning, the defensive plan was really good. They played really hard. They hit a crap load of threes. They hit 14 threes, 14 to 23 from three. You don't do that every day. They
Right.
weren't easy shots. It was a magical night. They just had an incredible night. And they ran Purdue out of the gym by the end of it. And you don't get many like that. They're not going to have another game like that this year, probably, where they beat a team that good, that soundly. Now, what of that is portable? I can tell you this, that Fred Hoiberg after the game was absolutely happy and excited and all those things. But that dude was locked all the way back in by the end of the press conference because I think he knows you have to follow up a game like this with a commensurate effort at Iowa, or you may not get within 10 points of Iowa. So like he was pretty businesslike even afterward, because I think he knows, okay, we beat Purdue. The one thing we can't do now is feel ourselves and then lose at Iowa and Rutgers, which is the next two games up.
Right. Yeah. And now, I mean, look what they've done from the Michigan State win, Indiana to Purdue. And I think the defensive part of it is the part that travels the best. That's what we've seen from them. Rick Mast defended his butt off. Josiah Alek was impressive in his moments. Sam Hoiberg, I think one of the most impactful sequences in basketball is when you do get a steal and layup. I mean, it's a huge swing. It doesn't stress your offense at all, and for Hoiberg to get those two steals and lay-ins on the other side, I mean, were just huge momentum spots for what Nebraska was doing, and it was so many guys contributing. That's the other thing I go back to. There was no, 40-point game from somebody, but guys were hitting shots. They were sharing the ball. It looked like an NBA offense. It looked like the offense that to a point that Fred Hoiberg thought that he was going to bring when he got here, all those years ago now. And so I think it's been interesting hearing the conversation afterwards too about like how this was Fred's signature win. And typically you don't get a chance to have a signature win this late in a tenure somewhere.
Yeah,
But they
good
did.
point.
And like it reminded me, Sam, of a couple of years ago. I mean, the discussion we were having 2 years ago was, okay, Fred Hoiberg and Scott Frost were both here. They were both offensive-minded coaches. They both had a plan. Neither one of them worked. Who's going to adapt? And now looking back, man, one of them adapted, one of them didn't. And it's just incredibly impressive to see the way that Hoiberg has sort of reimagined how he builds a team. It's not all necessarily slam dunk NBA prospects or trying to find those guys, but it's trying to find complementary pieces. And for them to do that was really, really impressive. And it sets up a pretty exciting couple of months for sure about whether they can use this to vault toward an NCAA tournament spot and maybe get that white whale of a postseason March Madness win.
Yeah, I think that the Big Ten is not so overwhelmingly good that you can do what you need to do, but simultaneously, because it's not overwhelmingly good, you probably need to win one or two more games than you normally would have to. So I don't think that you get in with 19 wins, like you're automatically in. 19 is fine. I mean, I think that's a fine number, but I'm not sure it gets you in. So, 19 would be 19 and 12 for those listening. Before you go to the Big Ten tournament, that's the best record they've had in a while. But I don't know that that gets you in. I think that this thing moves every single year. And shoot, the Big East is going to get seven or eight, and I'm not exaggerating. They are the teams that are at the top of the Big East are not the teams that everybody expected to be there. So you got to watch that. And the Big 12 is going to have a crap load of teams because of who's there and what they're doing, and BYU's in the tournament, and Houston's in the tournament. It's going to be like, 11 of the 14 Big 12 teams will be in, maybe 10 or something like that. So this is going to be challenging. I think Nebraska's got two feathers, two key feathers. The first one is they want Kansas State, and that's a big deal. That's a big, big win. I think that one was crucial to snag. And the second one is this Purdue game, because if you beat the conference champion, you beat in a legitimately good team, which Purdue really is, and you beat them by 16. You didn't beat them by one. You beat them by 16, and you didn't need overtime. I think the committee's gonna, because I think part of committee people are human. They think to themselves, on this team's best night, on Nebraska's best night, they won by 16 over Purdue, and they won on the road at K-State by 16. And not only that, they did it in completely different ways. One game was a defensive masterpiece, and the other one was an offensive gem. So I think those things really matter, and I don't think that'll help. That'll for sure help the committee. Oh, let's go to the national football stuff for a second. So Michigan won the national championship on Monday night, and isn't it just like the SEC to steal the thunder 2 days later with Nick Saban's retirement? I have a few thoughts, and I'd love your thoughts too. First of all, first of all, I commend Saban for retiring now, on a team that he loved versus feeling the need to get back to the top. Alabama has not been the best program in college football now for several years. They haven't really been the best program in college football. For a while, they won the national championship in 2020. That counts. It was a COVID national championship. It wasn't a full season. It was a weird season. It was 12 other things. But really, 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 Alabama was an ass-kicking program. What? 2018? 2017?
Sure, yeah.
2016? Now, what I'm saying right now is going to be viewed as blasphemous coming from a Nebraska writer, but I mean, I pay a lot of attention to national college football. And just so we're clear, Alabama didn't belong in the playoff in 2017. They got in and they beat a bad Clemson team, and then they beat a Georgia team that wasn't ready to do it. And in 2018, they got their butt handed to them. 2019, they didn't make it. Joe Burrow and LSU won the national championship in 2020. That's a national title. They deserve credit, whatever you want to call it. They did it. They got it done. 2021, they lost to Georgia in the national title game. 2022, they didn't make it to the playoff. And then this most recent year, they played their tails off, but they lost to Michigan, and they didn't make it to the national title. Alabama has been the best football program in college football in recent years. They've been maybe the biggest brand, but they haven't been the best program. And Georgia has, and now Michigan has. Like, of all the teams that you could imagine, Michigan's way, way up there. And I think Saban deserves some credit for maybe knowing that to get back to where he wanted to get was going to take a wrinkle or an adjustment that that man has too much self-respect to make, which is he sees what Ole Miss is doing in with NIL, and he sees what some of these in what Oregon's doing. Dan Lanning, by the way, very smart to remain at Oregon. And I think he's just like, yeah, not for me. Not doing this. Not handing my program over to boosters. Not doing it. And I don't know that that's all true, but the reality is it was going to get harder and harder. And he reinvented himself once when they I think they lost to Ole Miss a couple of times in a row, and he reinvented himself with Lane Kiffin. He went out and he got Lane Kiffin, and they revamped the offense and they changed who they were, and then they got, the next coordinator, and then they got Sark, and they reinvented themselves on offense. They were a pro style, hand it off, slow, boring offense. They reinvented themselves as a team that, got NFL quarterbacks and all that other stuff. But I think the next reinvention was going to be on the program management front, and I just don't know that he wanted to go. And I think so he retired. And now we need to chart what Jim Harbaugh is going to do. And for what it's worth, Jim Harbaugh, for all of his quirks, seems much more amenable and excited about the future of college football than Nick Saban did.
He does. And I think it helps that he's a little bit younger and he's maybe gonna be a part of that.
Maybe.
I mean, we'll see. I think probably more people watched that post-game celebration, or I know I wanted to see what Harbaugh would say in a post-game interview more than I would with what winning coaches would say. I don't know how many people would have tuned in if Saban had won and given a speech, but like you never know with a guy like Harbaugh. What he's going to do. Talk about a power void at the top of college football, though. Like, who does Alabama get? What does that look like? If Jim Harbaugh goes, I mean, yeah, Michigan could promote from within, and maybe that's not as big of a turnover. But I mean, you combine all that with what we're seeing in the NFL with Pete Carroll and Bill Belichick moving on from their programs. I mean, it's amazing. And I think to your point, that's the first thing that I thought was, especially with Saban and Harbaugh, was these are coaches who are seeing the times changing. And do you really want to be a part of that anymore? I'll be really curious to see what Saban says whenever he does an interview about it and how that breaks down. I kind of felt that way about Kirk Ferentz at Iowa. I mean, you hear how he talks about kind of the climate of college football right now. He strikes me as another guy who, if he's not had enough, he's getting awfully fed up with kind of how things are going. And it's different. It takes a different skill set. And it'll just be really, I kind of feel like in some ways, and we've talked about this with Nebraska too, like kind of feel like Rhule is equipped in a lot of ways to handle the current climate of things. 5, 10 years ago, when you didn't have free transfers, there was more of an emphasis maybe on the X's and O's and on just pure talent acquisition. And now it pays to be articulate, and it pays to emphasize relationships because you're recruiting your own roster every year, in addition to the portal, in addition to high school. So like it's fascinating. I think in real time we're seeing some of the skill sets and what it takes to win at a high level changing as the rules have changed. And guys like Saban who've won one way and who adapted, and you got to give him all the credit in the world for that. At some point you do kind of have to step back and be like, is this worth it? Is this possible? Is this what I really want to do? And I agree with you. I kind of feel like maybe that's a realization Saban reached.
Well, and is it worth it to go 11-2? Because to be clear, Alabama would have made the college football playoff every single year under Nick Saban going forward. I mean, it's a 12-team event. They would have made it every year. I don't think they would have emerged as the national champion. And I don't know if I think the guy is wired in a way where it's like, if I can't win it, then I'm not sure I want to do it. And if what it takes to win it is to do some things that you don't necessarily want to do, then I think, and he may just be doing it because he's ready to do it, but I think that's part of it too. Like Jay Wright could have won three or four more national championships, probably at Villanova, if Jay Wright had wanted to do what you need to do to win them, but he didn't. And so he walked away, and he's a great Fox analyst. I know he's on CBS, He's really good at what he does, and I'm sure he's making money. And maybe one day Jay Wright will return to the NBA or something. But he didn't need to do anything more than he had done, and he didn't want to do what needs to be done going forward in that sport in order to win. And in basketball, it's really tougher. It's even tougher. Because there, you really don't know what it's going to entail. And there's a lot more teams that can win the national championship in basketball because there's fewer players. And so all those things. So I'll be curious to see who they hire. I put it on Twitter. They should hire Dabo Swinney if Dabo wants to go there, because Dabo played there and he's won national championships. And he doesn't like NIL either that much, but I think he would be a good fit there if that's what they want, if Alabama wants that. I know Dan Lanning apparently was kicking the tires on it. It confuses me, honestly, why Alabama would reach out to him first, but whatever. He's going to apparently stay at Oregon, released a video to that effect. Welcome to the Big Ten. I'll just say this. I like that guy. And I think he's doing a good job up there. He'll learn this really quickly. Nebraska learned it. No one's going to be intimidated by Oregon. No one. They're not going to be afraid of him. They're not. No one will be intimidated. The psychological advantage that Oregon enjoyed over Washington State or Oregon State or whatever does not going to translate. They're going to have to earn it all over again. So can they do that? Sure. But they're going to have to earn it. Penn State's not going to be afraid of Oregon. Michigan's not going to be afraid. Ohio State's not going to be afraid. Wisconsin's not going to be afraid. Iowa's not going to be afraid. People think Iowa's going to be afraid. Iowa's not going to be afraid. Now, they may not win, but they won't be afraid. No one's going to be afraid of USC. No one's afraid of Washington. Like, those teams need to know, because this happened to Nebraska. And when Nebraska went into the Big Ten, they had just finished a 10-3 season or whatever it was, and were pretty damn good. And they were still Nebraska in a lot of ways. No one's going to be afraid of these teams. Now they can come in and punch Nebraska, punch the Big Ten in the nose and earn it and steal it. But no, don't ever underestimate the arrogance of Big Ten. They will not be afraid. So, Dan Lanning can smoke his cigars and put stuff on film. None of it's going to matter. They're going to have to go earn it. It will not be given to them. They'll have to take it. So we'll see. We'll see. We're going to find out if Oregon can deal with the physical onslaught that the Big Ten is week in and week out. And people are like, oh, no, I'm serious now. It's one thing to beat one Big Ten team in September, it's another to play nine of them. And there you are in November, and you have to deal with that BS. It's not fun. You don't want it. It's different. And people laugh when I say that, but just get in the league, mess around, and find out, and we'll see. So he's got a whole big thing going on, but he's going to have to earn it in the Big Ten. And nobody's going to look at this guy and go, wow, you went 9-3 in the Big Ten, and look how great you are. Because James Franklin's been doing that for 5 years, and nobody's afraid of him either. No one's afraid of Penn State. So James Franklin's been doing what Dan Lanning's been doing. And nobody looks at James Franklin and says, now there's a guy that should be the head coach of every single team in the country. Dan Lanning's going to find out really fast. It's not easy.
That's right. And Washington will too. I mean, they got a taste of having the ball run down their throats for 3.5 quarters. So the parallels to Nebraska are really interesting. And you laid it out well, but the mystique side and the just the change of the style of teams they play, the weather, you're not playing in California and Arizona on the road. You're playing in Indiana and Michigan and Ohio, and it's different. And I'll be really interested to see how quickly they adjust. It's so weird because there's so many moving goalposts. Because again, they could maybe Oregon does go 9-3 next year, but 9-3 next year is probably maybe good enough to make the playoff. Certainly good enough to be on the fringe. So, it's such an interesting juxtaposition because in the one sense, you're going to see programs losing more games than their fan bases are used to seeing. But at the same time, you're going to see programs tasting or on the brink of the college football playoff
Right.
in a way that they never were. So, like, how do you square that in your mind? I suppose they'd take the losses just to have the shot at the national title.
For sure. And the way that Oregon's Big Ten schedule is set up next year, they play uninterrupted, no bye weeks, Michigan State, Ohio State, Purdue, Illinois, Michigan, Maryland, Wisconsin. And then they have a bye week before they play Washington to end the year because that's going to be a rival. But you heard what I just rattled off there.
It's a meat grinder.
That's real. Like, okay, you'll kick Michigan State's ass. Then you'll play Ohio State. You won't kick their ass. And then you have to fly to Purdue. And then you come back and play Illinois. Illinois is not very talented, but they will hit you. Then you have to fly back across the country to Michigan. Then in 2 weeks, you have to fly back across the country to Wisconsin on November 16th. And it'll be cold after you've played Ohio State and you've played Michigan. And the toll accumulates on the body. Somebody there ought to ask Casey Rogers what it's like before Casey leaves. Because he can
Yeah.
tell.
It's a great point.
What's it like, Casey? And he'll tell him it sucks. It's hard. And I'm sure, or he would say Oregon's better than all those other teams. I get that. But the physical toll that you take, and I think Casey experienced that in 2021, didn't he? Or maybe he left after the 2020 season. I can't remember. But like the 2021 season for Nebraska, like the physical toll is brutal. It's just, and you have to hold up to it. All right, that is our podcast for this week. Hey, Tom Chattel will be back next week. He is driving down as we speak to talk to Fred Hoiberg. He'll have a column on Friday. That's why Tom's not here today. He was on vacation and now he's back, and he'll be back next week. No worries there. We'll talk lots of stuff like the Husker football. We missed Tom today too, but he'll be back next week, and we'll get all the thoughts that he has about Husker football, about where the basketball team is, all the good stuff. So for Evan, I'm Sam. Thanks for listening.